and FM Madison.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, April 21st edition to Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, we have an episode from Building Bridges Radio, the longest-running and best-known labor and community affairs radio program in the New York metropolitan area and probably nationally as well. Building Bridges' Mimi Goldberg and Ken Nash talked to labor journalist Sarah Jaffe about her new book, Work Won't Love You Back, and about a community labor solidarity story coming out of Minnesota. And eventually, they tie their discussion into international labor and humanitarian solidarity. But first, we have the news.
According to a new study by World Weather Attribution, or WWA, an international network of scientists focusing on extreme weather events, human-caused climate change contributed to an unusually intense and lethal hot spell throughout West Africa's Sahel region in April. Temperatures in Mali and Burkina Faso climbed to more than 45 degrees Celsius, which is 113 degrees Fahrenheit, between April 1st and April 5th, with relatively high minimum temperatures overnight. The high temperatures also occurred during Ramadan, the Muslim fasting month, and there were frequent power cuts, increasing the risk of heat-related deaths. The Sahel is accustomed to heat waves during March and April, but the WWA said the extreme hot spell in April would have been 1.4 degrees centigrade cooler if humans had not warmed the planet by burning fossil fuels. The WWA said that lack of data did not allow them to give a precise number of deaths due to heat. It did estimate there were hundreds or possibly thousands of heat-related deaths and warned such extreme heat will become much more common without greater global efforts to reduce planet warming emissions.
France and Germany co-sponsored a conference in Paris last Monday to solicit pledges of aid for Sudan on the first anniversary of what aid workers described as a neglected but devastating conflict. Donors pledged more than $2 billion, led by the EU, France, Germany, the US, and Britain. The UN was seeking $2.7 billion this year for aid to 25 million people inside Sudan and another $1.4 billion for assistance in neighboring countries that have housed hundreds of thousands of Sudanese refugees. Prior to the conference, that appeal was just 6% funded. In addition, UN and aid organization efforts to get food and medical help to people have been thwarted by unremitting battles between the Sudanese army and the Sudanese paramilitary rapid support forces. At the end of the conference, French President Emmanuel Macron said, quote, "Unfortunately, the amount that we mobilized today is still probably less than was mobilized by several powers since the start of the war to help one or the other side kill each other," unquote. Macron stressed the need to coordinate the international efforts to resolve the conflict and also to stop foreign support for the warring parties.
Authorities in Pakistan called for emergency services to remain on high alert last week after heavy rains killed hundreds of people across Pakistan and Afghanistan, and more severe weather is predicted. Afghan authorities said Tuesday that flooding from seasonal rains killed at least 50 people. Pakistani authorities also said that at least 50 people died in Pakistan in the storms. Most of the Pakistani deaths were reported in the northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, where rains and flash floods caused landslides, damaged homes, and uprooted trees. In eastern Punjab province, where 21 people were reported dead, rains also caused dozens of houses to collapse. 7 people were killed in the southwestern Balochistan province, and streets were flooded in Quetta, the Balochistan capital, as well as in the northwestern city of Peshawar. In Afghanistan, flash floods were reported in 20 of the country's 34 provinces. Houses were damaged or destroyed and livestock killed. Flooding also damaged large areas of agricultural land and roads. Yesterday, Pakistani authorities issued a flood alert for the northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa because of the melting of glaciers in several mountainous districts and warned of a heavy loss of life if people do not move to safer locations.
A spokesperson for the Myanmar military government told media that Myanmar's detained former leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from prison to house arrest because of the hot weather. Suu Kyi has been detained by the Myanmar military since it overthrew her government in a 2021 coup. She faces 27 years in prison for crimes ranging from treason to bribery to violations of the telecommunications law, charges she denies. She was previously held under house arrest for a total of 15 years under a former junta at a colonial-style family residence in Yangon's Inya Lake, where she famously spoke to crowds of supporters over the metal gates of the property. World leaders and pro-democracy activists have repeatedly called for her release. A spokesperson for the NUG shadow government called for the unconditional release of Suu Kyi and U Win Mint, Myanmar's ousted president, who has also been moved to house arrest.
The United States announced last week that it is reimposing its sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector. President Joe Biden's administration announced it would not renew a license that expired Thursday, which had partially eased sanctions that were imposed in 2019. General License 44, which authorized oil and gas transactions with Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, had been in effect since last October, when a U.S.-backed election deal was reached between Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's government and the Venezuelan opposition in Barbados. Following the agreement, Maduro's government continued to oppress the opposition by disqualifying opposition leader Maria Corina Machado to run for president, jailing members of her campaign team, and blocking registration for millions of voters. America's Society Council of the Americas Vice President Eric Farnsworth said, quote, "We lifted the sanctions prematurely before the Maduro regime had actually done anything, so we took away our own leverage," unquote. Venezuela's fuel sales are expected to take a hit following the sanctions, while U.S. oil companies operating in Venezuela will have to scramble to seek special authorizations.
Water has been rising in the drought-stricken Panama Canal, which has allowed an increased number of ships per day to pass through the canal. Authorities aim to raise daily transits to 31, starting May 16th, and a 32 ships per day in June. Currently, the limit sits at 27 ships per day. The increased water is due to the arrival of the rainy season in April, which leaves the Panama Canal Authority, or ACP, optimistic that water levels will improve. The ACP said in an advisory, quote, "Current forecasts indicate that steady rainfall will arrive in late April and continue for a few months," unquote. The ACP aims to return the canal to its full capacity by 2025. Under optimal conditions, the average number of vessels per day are between 35 and 36. In 2022, an average of 39 ships went through the canal daily. But since July 2023, daily transits have been limited because of water shortages in the artificial lakes Gatun and Alajuela. In November, only 22 vessels passed through the canal each day, and that was reduced to 18 in February.
Germany's defense minister, Boris Pistorius, announced yesterday that the frigate Hamburg will be sent to the Red Sea early next August to help secure maritime traffic that was disrupted by the Yemeni Houthi militia. The Hamburg will take over the duties of the German ship Hessen, which left the area yesterday as it ended its mission that began in late February. The Hessen, with about 240 military personnel on board, was part of the European Union's mission Aspides, or Shield in ancient Greek, to protect commercial shipping near Yemen. During its mission, the Hessen accompanied 27 commercial ships and repelled Houthi drones and missiles four times. Since the start of Israel's latest war on Gaza in October of 2023, the Houthis have carried out dozens of attacks in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden against commercial ships owned or operated by Israel.
The president of Mauritania, Mohamed Ould Cheikh El Ghazouani, published a decree today stating that the first round of presidential elections will be held on June 29th, while a possible second round would be held on July 14th. It is expected that the 67-year-old outgoing president, who has led Mauritania since 2019, is the most likely candidate in these elections, although he has not yet officially announced his candidacy. Eight candidates have announced that they will participate in the elections. Among them is former President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz, who was in power from 2009 to 2019 and was sentenced in December 2023 to 5 years in prison on charges of abusing his power to amass a fortune. His lawyers have appealed the decision. The famous anti-slavery activist and opposition figure Biram Dah Abadi, who came second in the most recent presidential elections, also announced his intention to run, leading this vast, pivotal country in the Sahel region between North and Sub-Saharan Africa. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
This year, the 30th anniversary of South Africa's first democratic elections in 1994. Analysts and experts are suggesting that the African National Congress, or ANC, the Liberation Party that has governed since 1994, will not have an easy time prevailing. The main reason is the economy. Millions of predominantly black South Africans continue to suffer the same economic challenges as they did under apartheid. Most do not earn enough for their basic needs, and hunger and lack of housing haunt much of the country. In addition, inequality and unemployment have increased, and water and electricity services are expensive and unreliable. These bleak conditions threaten unrest and resulting instability, which in turn discourages investment and improvement in the economy. Faced with this reality, the ANC has its work cut out to convince voters that it has viable solutions for the country before the May 29th elections. But the ANC itself is under pressure to heal its internal divisions and address corruption within the party. New voting rules will also come into play. On May 29th, South Africans will vote for a new National Assembly and for provincial legislators for each province. Until now, voters chose a party, and the percentage of votes the party got determined the percentage of parliamentary seats it held in the 400-seat National Assembly. The party had more than 50% of the seats, will elect the president. This year, though, for the first time, South Africans can run for parliament without being affiliated with a party. A separate ballot has been created to allow people to vote for an independent, and if the candidate meets a certain vote threshold, to make it into parliament. The number of seats available to the two major parties are reduced by the number of independent winners. The current South African president, and also the head of the ANC, Cyril Ramaphosa, is slightly favored to win at this point, but a big threat emerged in December when former president Jacob Zuma declared his candidacy as the head of a new party. Zuma has a sordid history of being forced to resign, being thrown out of office, being indicted for various crimes, most of them mostly of corruption and morals. Yet he has maintained his popularity with the youth, and in his home province, KwaZulu-Natal, and neighboring Gauteng, both populous areas. This threatens the ANC, which pundits are still predicting can put together a coalition to win if they are able to woo their usual partners. And that is the struggle that will play out over the next 6 weeks.
Indians began voting in the first phase of the world's largest elections on Friday as Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi seeks a third term. Opposing Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, is an alliance of 24 parties that includes the main opposition Indian National Congress Party that urged voters to end hatred and injustice in a statement on X. Some 969 million people have registered to vote. Al Jazeera mentions that this number makes India's electorate bigger than the combined population of the 27 European Union member states. The overall number includes 18 million first-time voters and 197 million voters in their 20s. Those who turned out on Friday were the first of seven phases that will go on until the beginning of June. They use electronic voting machines to press the blue button corresponding to the serial number, name, and symbol of the candidate of their choice, or to choose the option none of the above. Some commentators are sure that Modi will prevail in elections, while others point out that attacks on minorities, mainly Muslims, since Modi's rise to power, and an alleged gag on free speech and media are among issues likely to affect the elections. Voters are also worried about unemployment, inflation, and rural distress. The opposition promises greater affirmative action and more handouts while stressing what they call the need to save democratic institutions. Still others point to the disarray of the opposition. So it's not going to be an easy election to call before the votes are counted on June 4th. But it's fairly sure that the numbers of voters will be large. In the multi-phase 2019 polls, the average turnout was 67%.
Colombia cut its export of electricity to its neighbor, Ecuador, which was then forced to declare a state of emergency. A drought fueled by the El Niño weather pattern has caused water levels to drop throughout both countries, notably in reservoirs used for electricity. Both countries depend on hydroelectric power plants to meet their energy needs. A minimum flow of water is required to spin the turbines that power the plants. The reservoirs currently stand at about 30% of their capacity, and 27% is critical. Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa announced on X that along with declaring a state of emergency, he was also replacing his energy minister, saying, quote, "I have asked for the resignation of the Minister of Energy, Andreas Orobo, and we have begun an investigation into sabotage in certain areas and power plants." Noboa did not give details on what that sabotage entailed. Last Monday night, Orobo announced a temporary rationing of electricity due to the drought and asked the population to, quote, "reduce energy consumption during this critical week," unquote. Noboa overrode Aroba's order and announced, quote, "We are not going to have more blackouts this week," unquote. He also said household electricity bills would be halved this week. The drought has led to water rationing in Colombia and has affected 10 million people in Bogota and its surrounding areas. Colombia's mining and energy minister, Andres Camacho, said that rains are expected soon to break the dry spells that have also led to hundreds of forest fires. Camilo Prieto, a climate change professor at Bogota's Javeriana University, told the Associated Press news agency that this year's drought is not as bad as some in the past, but he warned that energy consumption has grown in both countries, leaving their residents vulnerable to extreme weather patterns brought on by El Nino.
Islamic State fighters in Syria killed 28 soldiers and militants in forces loyal to the Syrian government during two attacks last Thursday in areas under Syrian army control. The victims were from the Al-Quds Brigade, a Syrian faction that includes Palestinian fighters loyal to the Syrian government, which is also supported by Russia. In late March, ISIS ambushed and killed 8 Syrian soldiers in the desert, bringing the current year death total to more than 200 soldiers from the Syrian government forces and militants loyal to it and Iran. ISIS took control of large areas in Iraq and Syria in 2014, but has suffered successive defeats since. By 2019, the Syrian Democratic Forces, with U.S. support, announced the defeat of ISIS after months of fighting. Elsewhere in Syria, the Syrian media confirmed today that a fire broke out in the crude oil transport line east of the central city of Homs, noting that firefighting teams were able to put out the fire, but were still working on controlling the oil spill. Apparently, the fire broke out during an attempt to pierce the line for the purpose of stealing the oil. One of the suspects was killed and at least 3 injured. Syria has been experiencing a prolonged civil war since 2011 as a result of what started as an unarmed protest but became armed by outside sources, leading to more than 500,000 deaths and the displacement of millions. Now, 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, according to the United Nations statistics, and the country is also suffering from the collapse of its currency, the Syrian lira, against the U.S. dollar. More than $500 billion are estimated to be needed for Syrian reconstruction to return to the level of 2011. The Syrian Ministry of Oil estimated the 2021 direct and indirect oil sector losses at more than $92 billion, while the Syrian areas under U.S. control in the east contain 90% of Syria's oil reserves.
The United Nations Children's Fund, known as UNICEF, said today that the killing of children in Palestine, quote, must stop and there must be an immediate ceasefire, unquote. Adele Kader, regional director of UNICEF, said in a statement that, quote, during the past 72 hours, Israel killed 3 children in the city of Tulkarem in the West Bank and at least 14 others in the city of Rafah in the besieged Gaza Strip, unquote. 13 Palestinians, including 9 children, were killed by Israeli bombing on 2 homes east of Rafah, according to a preliminary toll. Israel is claiming to confront the last stronghold of the Islamic resistance movement, Hamas, despite increasing international warnings of catastrophic repercussions in light of the presence of about 1.4 million displaced Gazans in the city. The UN official stressed that children in the state of Palestine have been stuck in a tragic and vicious cycle of violence for a very long time. The Gaza war disproportionately affects children. From last Thursday until yesterday, the Israeli army carried out a military operation in the Nur Shams camp in Gaza, which left 14 Palestinians dead and destroyed most roads in the camp. The Palestinian Health Ministry has accused Israel of, quote, deliberately obstructing, unquote, healthcare services for Palestinians in the West Bank. In addition to the Israeli occupation army's ongoing operations, settlers escalated their armed attacks in the West Bank, including occupied Jerusalem. In total, the Israeli attacks have left 486 Palestinians dead and 4,900 wounded in the West Bank alone since October 7th of 2023. Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari said that the chief of staff has approved the next steps for operations in Gaza. Hagari added in a statement that the chief of staff has also approved plans to continue operations on the southern front and indicated that the occupation forces are preparing the field for the upcoming ground operation. He claimed that recent attacks targeted military infrastructure of the Hamas movement in the central Gaza Strip. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the U.S. House's approval of a $26 billion aid package for Israel, claiming the funding will embolden Israel in the ongoing genocide against the Palestinians.
And that's a wrap of news from around the world for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, the Americas Society, Anadolu Agency, the Associated Press, The Deep Dive, El Universo, The Guardian, The Independent, Merco Press, Middle East Monitor, The New York Times, National Public Radio, Reuters, and Sana. We'll be right back.
I'm Amy Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're building bridges, not walls, to keep out the world's peoples or apartheid structures to segregate and divide. We speak with Sarah Jaffe, labor journalist and author of Work Won't Love You Back. I got to tell that to my employer about what she describes as one of the most important labor stories in the country. Sarah Jaffe, you've given us an extremely enthusiastic and wonderful story. The full name of our show is not just Building Bridges, it's Building Bridges, Your Community Labor Report. And for decades, we've been waiting for the working class to come together, unions to think of people in their full reality, their identity, where they live, how they work, how they organize, and for the community to understand that ultimately empowerment is based on the coalition with the sources of production and the working class coming together. So you've got this great story. Do start us off with, isn't it being a little arrogant to say that one of the most important labor stories in the country is Minneapolis?
No, why would it be? I mean, I think it's a little arrogant to assume all the best labor stories are on the East Coast.
I said Minneapolis. I meant Minnesota, but...
Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the surrounding suburbs.
And, right. Ken said the Minneapolis general strike, for sure. Yeah, we are a bit chauvinistic and arrogant from New York. The revolution has not started here. But do get us started on this very, very strategic, important development that you do a wonderful story on.
Yeah, I think what's happening in Minneapolis, or in the Twin Cities, let's say, is so interesting precisely because it has been developing for 10, 12 years on the ground. I first started covering what was going on in Minnesota during and after the Occupy movement, when the spinoff of Occupy Homes, which did have at least, you know, some start in New York, really took off in Minneapolis and in Atlanta. And so Occupy Homes there was an attempt to move out of parks and into trying to keep people in homes that they were being evicted from or foreclosed upon. And that's one of many connections that have been made in that, in those cities, in that area since then. So we're seeing things like unions working with worker centers, which is not, again, rare to anybody who's watching labor in New York City. But those relationships can often be really fraught. And in the Twin Cities, they've managed to have pretty extensive, deep, and collaborative relationships where the unions that often have more money and more power are not sort of walking all over their smaller community partners, you know? And then when combined with that, you see housing organizing, like I mentioned, and climate organizing and organizing around police violence and police killings, all of this coming together to, you know, to say that workers, as people have said many times before me, don't live single issue lives. And so thinking about the four main demands that this this network of organizations made this past week were around fair wages, but also about decent housing, good schools, and a livable climate. And when you think about that, right, it's we're literally breathing the same air. We're all living in cities that, you know, to whatever degree, maybe not as expensive as New York, but we're all living through housing crises wherever we are. We're watching decades of underfunding of schools and other public services chip away at our quality of life. And all of that, you know, starts in the workplace with crappy wages, abusive bosses, all of that fun stuff. So when you look at it that way, right, these are interests that we all have. And so workers and members of all these community groups who are also workers, right, because again, the community member is a worker somewhere else most of the time, unless you're lucky enough to be retired or independently wealthy or a child. And so they come together around one demand or one question, which was, what could we win together? And that involved lining up things like contract expiration dates for the different unions, actions that different worker centers could have, deadlines that other kinds of action could have that weren't necessarily a contract expiration, but that could be a target for action, so that all week you had workers on strike, you had picket lines, you had informational pickets, you had marches on the boss, you had community meetings, you had debates around the future of social housing in Minnesota. You sort of saw everything in the streets in 1 week, which is kind of amazing.
Now, this, I mean, what really struck me also was the diversity of the mm-hmm. different groups, both within the community and the labor. Not only that, but you've got groups that are black and white and brown. Mm-hmm. And give us some kind of fill in some of those gaps as to who we were talking about, that it's not just like mm-hmm. teachers or lawyers, or give us some idea about the kinds of people we're talking about.
Yeah, so you had the two teachers unions in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and also the school services workers, right? So everybody in the schools who's not a teacher, they're organized in a different union with SEIU. There's SEIU Local 26, which is a lot of building services workers, a lot of whom are Black and Latino. You have worker centers like Situl, which is primarily in the Latino community, but they're organizing everybody from restaurant workers to janitors to construction workers. You have a group called Unidos Minnesota, which is working around green jobs in the climate future, and also things like retrofitting homes, which you can imagine in Minnesota, trying to have climate safe homes is kind of important because it gets really cold in the winter and really warm in the summer. You have organizations like IX, which is a tenants union. Again, that started out primarily in Latino community and has branched out from there. And they've actually recently won actual buildings, control of buildings away from a landlord and into a community-owned cooperative. So you really have like quite a variety of different organizations that are some based in ethnic communities, some based in particular workplaces, some based in issues, right, when we're talking about climate change. But all of them, again, are facing the same issues that, again, I would say most working class people are facing, which is like the rent's too damn high, the wages are too damn low, everything is on fire, and the kids need to go to school.
Yeah. What I want to know is what many of us have been trying to create these coalitions mm-hmm. for a long time. So here you have before March 2nd, right? 15,000 workers had already taken strike votes. Right. And though some of them had settled, some 10,000 more may still walk off the job this coming week and stuff. But how? Yeah. What was the spark that created this wonderful wonderful prairie fighter? How do, to go back into Ken's question, really, the diversity, unfortunately, mm-hmm. we don't come from the kind of society where people perceive of themselves as a working class, that race and, of course, the issues of misogyny and sexual identification mm-hmm. and orientation and so on have kept us mm-hmm. very siloed. What in the world was the spark that created this marvelous prairie fire and brought people together? What could we
think
win
it's several
together?
Things, right? You sort of have things like the Occupy movement that got people thinking we are the 99% and not we are building service workers or we are teachers or we are, you know, renters with a crappy landlord. But actually, think about we are the 99%. What does that really mean? You have some of the unions that had progressive leadership either take over fairly recently or have been there for a while. The Building Services Local, for instance, is in the tradition of Justice for Janitors, which is a movement from the late 80s, early 90s around organizing janitorial workers, again, who were mostly outsourced contract workers, mostly Latino. And that was a different way of thinking about doing that kind of organizing that they really never let go of in that area. And then you had successive movements for Black Lives waves, right? So you had the killing of Jamar Clark in 2015, which sparked an occupation of the police precinct. Then you had the killing of Philando Castile, who was a schools worker. And that really had a huge impact on the schools unions, right? Because it wasn't just saying Black Lives Matter at school. It was like literally one of our coworkers was just killed by the police. The St. Paul Federation of Teachers and then the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers are following the examples of bargaining for the common good that comes out of places like Chicago, right? St. Paul was one of the early teachers unions that followed Chicago down that path of social justice unionism. And then one of the leaders of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers was one of the people who was in George Floyd Square in 2020, right? When George Floyd was killed. George Floyd was killed half a block away from the building that Situl and IX have their offices in, which is just a sort of horrific coincidence. But it meant that these organizations had space on that block to be ground zero. So people could do everything from get food and water and masks to, you know, because it was still peak pandemic, to get away from tear gas. And in those moments, you build a lot of trust that you kind of can't force otherwise. You know, I think that Minneapolis being the center of that uprising, we can kind of forget. And also, you know, when it kicked off in 2020, it's always surprising because you never know exactly when it's going to happen. But it didn't surprise me at all that it was happening in Minneapolis, because I'd been following the organizing that had been going on the ground in these places, and the work of groups like the Black Visions Collective, and now the New Justice Project, to consolidate on the, saying the shift in analysis feels like too academic to say, right, that happens in these streets. But when you think about before 2020, we were talking, largely the big political conversation was like police reform. And then really after 2020, people were saying defund the police, abolish the police. Those leaps don't just happen, right? They happen because people have been organizing around those demands beforehand, and then they are able to spread from there. And they were able to spread from somewhere like Minneapolis because people on the ground had been making those demands and doing that actual work of moving money away from policing and into different community services, schools, parks, things like that, that all of the workers involved in this week of action work on, right? You've got park service workers, say, right, who can suddenly see that, like, oh my God, all this money is going into the police that we could be paying more to do. When I spoke with the head of he's the business manager of the La Yuna local, right, which is a laborers union that works. They represent the park service workers, sewer maintenance workers, basically all of the messy, dirty stuff that we rely on that we forget about until it breaks, they do. And he was telling me that one of the things that has happened in recent years is that they get called in when the city evicts a homeless encampment. So suddenly these workers who are supposed to be, you know, keeping the parks clean are now being tasked with helping the city evict people who are unhoused. And they're saying, we don't want to be doing that. We're not trained for that. We, you know, this could be alleviated if the city actually made sure people had homes. And so you have these moments of sort of organic shifts that also have an impact where they are, right? That it advances the way people are thinking about their interests, not just as members of a specific union, but as a class and as a community, as the people of the Twin Cities who all have to live and work and interact together.
So, you know, there was, you're calling it, and I love the phrase, it's so correct, an ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
An ecosystem, and you mentioned something very specific, and I still want to dig deeper into the how.
Yeah.
Local 26 and Centro de Trabajadores Unidos en la Lucha, right? A
yes.
worker center
yes.
And a local. Now,
yeah.
quite frankly, there has been no love of labor's lost between the generally the construction trades and mm-hmm. worker centers. And we mm-hmm. come for such a rapidly
yeah.
anti-immigrant context, particularly
yeah.
with
mm-hmm.
the opportunism of the electoral system, both parties really.
Yes.
So the unions have never, aside from the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and unions that were made up almost exclusively of immigrant workers, they've never been great on working with worker centers. There's always mm-hmm. a kind of contempt. How in the world did this partnership, this ecosystem, this ecosystem really develop?
Yeah.
It's so exciting and it's so encouraging, and we need to replicate it here because we
yeah.
need to become less fragmented and really become a
yeah.
movement for the empowerment of the working class.
Yeah, I mean, so two things here, because I want to sort of separate what you just said there into two parts. The first thing is the ecosystem thinking. I got that from my friend and comrade Rodrigo Nunez, who wrote a wonderful book called Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal. And the way he talks about it, I think, is so compelling, because it's a way of thinking about your organizing where, you know, you might be organizing as, say, a tenants union, and therefore your interest is in getting the rent lowered, getting this landlord out of your tenant, your members' lives, whatever it is. But you can think, how does what I'm demanding here coincide with what other people are demanding, what other organizations are demanding? How does it help them if we advance our demands, right? So if they are now, one of the things they're organizing around is social housing, and they want locally funded and controlled social housing rather than, you know, public housing that's funded by HUD and all of that, which, you know, again, I don't have to tell New Yorkers anything about the problem with the federally funded public housing. But the doing that, what if they also demand that those buildings, if they're built, they have to be built by contractors making union rates, that have to sign on to CITUL's demands that they've made around safe and fair contracting? What if they are built to green specifications, and that means, you know, everything from making them more attractive to the surrounding community to actually, you know, helping to mitigate the damn climate crisis, or even just the air in the neighborhood, right? That you can think about that in a way that literally affects the ecosystem where you are, but also affects all the other organizations that you might be working with, right? So thinking about organizing ecologically, right? It doesn't mean that you sort of give up all your autonomy and follow Local 26 wherever they say we're going, but it is to say that, like, we think about how are we, A, not screwing over our partners, our comrades, our neighbors, and B, how does our work complement each other so that we can make these demands in sort of overlapping and synchronous ways, while also, you know, going out on a limb and testing something and saying, maybe this will work and maybe it won't. And knowing that, like, others will have your back if there's a, you know, momentary screw up, right? If something goes wrong. And so thinking about CITUL and the building trades is a really interesting example, right? Because it comes from their work alongside Local 26, organizing janitors in big box stores. And that is, again, that's organizing the janitors who work at places like Target, which is headquartered in the Twin Cities. So that was an important way to Target.
Yes.
By saying this company,
its
headquarters is right here, right? We can put pressure on this company and say, you are hiring janitors for minimum wage and stealing their wages. And yeah, maybe it's a subcontractor, but Target's ultimately responsible. And they succeeded in that, right? So the janitors at these retail stores have union contracts now, right? One of a couple of the people that I spoke to in the story have union contracts because of that organizing. So the building trades look at that and say, oh, wait, this works. And also, you know, whether or not people like it. Immigrant workers are here in the U.S. They're working right now. They're doing things. And a lot of the time in the building trades, they're doing work that the big unions maybe don't think about or don't want or sort of dismiss as being beneath them. But that still creates a space to lower wage scales, to lower safety protections, right? If you have a bunch of workers who are working under the table, who are not being supervised by people who give one tiny iota about their safety, this has an effect on standards everywhere, even if the unions at first kind of think like, oh, we don't care about those guys anyway, they're the competition. So, you know, thinking practically about these workers are here, they're doing the work. How do we make it better and safer and lift the floor for everyone so that our conditions don't go down to where theirs are? And also just looking at the work Situl had done with this other union and saying like, oh, these guys are good at what they do, you know, and thinking like, okay. And I, you know, I must say like the unions are not perfect on this by any stretch of the imagination, but the labor movement in this country has been realizing that immigrant workers are here. They are part of the workforce. They are part of our communities. They are our neighbors. They are our friends. And also that, like, frankly, they often bring a lot of organizing knowledge from their countries of origin, from other places that they've lived and worked, from political traditions that have been crunched in this country. And we can learn a lot from the tactics and strategies that they have, right? So some of these organizations in Minnesota are taking inspiration from things like the Zapatistas, right? And thinking about autonomy and how do we manage to do real democracy means that we get to make decisions for ourselves, that we have self-determination within our community, within our neighborhoods, within our housing, within our schools. That kind of political tradition that, like, you know, tried to mash out of us in this country. Some of these workers are coming in with that knowledge that they can bring a level of not only militancy, but like real experience to organizing.
The 30s, you know? Revisited. My gosh, where did the labor movement come from in so many ways? All these radical traditions from abroad, the immigrant workforce, and of course, the Zapatistas of Mexico. Right. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Well, time is flying, and you have many, many subjects that you're talking about that are not always in this country. So why don't we shift gears just a bit and talk about the tech workers organizing against the humiliation and the attacks in Gaza.
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of questions to start there, but one of the things that I think is really interesting about the tech worker organizing, right, is that they're organizing around the products that they make. And if you look at the sort of division of labor at a lot of these big tech companies, workers regularly have no idea what they're making. They're being asked to work on some portion of code for some portion of thing. And they really don't know what it's going to be used for. And then they find out by reading in the news that this company has signed this, you know, massive deal to build some AI program for the Israeli military or something like that, or the American military or the police or whatever it is. And so we've seen this organizing that really got, it started before Trump was elected, but it really got jump-started in 2016, where a lot of tech workers were saying, we don't want to make a Muslim registry. We don't want to help you, you know, militarize the border. We don't want to do any of these things. And we want to pressure these companies that have a public face, right, a consumer-facing outlet, sort of like the pressure on Target that I was just talking about, to not be evil, which used to be Google's tagline. And so we're seeing that again now where, again, these big tech companies are making all of this tech that has been used in Gaza, has been used in the occupied territories, has been used in a variety of ways. And the workers are saying, like, actually, we didn't sign on to do this. We want not only to know what we're doing, but we want to say no to what we're doing here. We want to say that we want no part of this and that the company should have no part of this. And, you know, we saw a worker stand up and protest at a public event the other night and I believe got fired. And, like, we're... you know, again, we're seeing this over and over and over again with these companies. In the piece I wrote for The Progressive, I quote Alex Hanna, who is somebody I've known for a very long time because they were once upon a time involved in the Wisconsin Capitol Uprising as the head of the grad students union back in Wisconsin in 2011. So Alex and I go way back. And Alex was working at Google's ethical AI department and is one of many people pushed out because Google no longer really cared about being ethical about its AI. But it turns out that, you know, you can't tell a bunch of tech workers that their opinions matter and that they're very important to the success of the company. And also, screw you, you don't get to have opinions, sit down and shut up.
Well, I must say that we need to have you back. We need you to actually come back with some of these marvelous networks of unions and community groups from Minnesota to continue to whet our appetite, to excite us who have worked together for more than a decade, to leverage their collective power and to educate, agitate, and organize the rest of us to do what? To empower the working class, to empower the total working class, where we live, where we work, and, of course, for how we organize. Sarah Jaffe, you are marvelous, and I strongly recommend reading her book, which has this wonderful cynical title, Work. What? Work won't love you back when workers
work won't love you back.
When workers decide what to make. But you know what? We love you. We love your enthusiasm, your energy, and bringing us these optimistic stories and helping us to realize that the power is within us. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and I'm telling you to continue to do what? Educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for another world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so. Thank you for listening.
And that's Worldview for this week. Thank you to Building Bridges, Mimi Rosenberg, Ken Nash, and Sarah Jaffe for our feature. Very interesting. And please try to remember that Cassandra Dixon is in Istanbul and about ready to sail for Gaza. And you can find out all about our friends and what they're doing and what's happening in Gaza on Madison Rafa. That's Rafa, R-A-F-A-H, madisonrafa.org. And thank you to the Worldview Collective, Gil Halstead, Buya Jemme, Sabia Tille, Maria Brunetta, and to WART News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And thank you for listening. And please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, and WORTFM.org. And now, stay tuned for Salamat.
Worldview is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us here at this station if you're interested in joining our collective to bring world issues to the airwaves. Worldview can be heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
بالعربي إن إربي كويسة يجوا يساعدوه بدفن أبوه أخذ المجرفة وهرب.
Translation: For those who do not appreciate kindness and do evil to those who just did a good deed to them. Well, so that's going to take a little bit of explanation.
Well, the translation, I think I put in the wrong. I put the description under the translation, and the translation under description. Oh. Silly me. But technically, translated literally, this is a. They came to help him bury his father. You know, the recently died father.
Mm-hmm.
And he stole the shovel and ran off with it.
Nice. Nice.